Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
Simran Sethi is an imperfect greenie. She loves eating meat and she warns against getting trapped in a cycle of judgment. Hailed as an eco-hero by some, she's in Australia on tour and joins me now along with Amy Brown, the co-director of a film about funerals. Not just any funerals, though. We're talking green funerals. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Have either of you planned your funeral yet?
For someone who talks about it all the time, I actually haven't created a will of any sort, but I think everyone knows that I want a green burial. It's a matter of figuring out where to have it in Australia.
Simran, have you?
No, I've not given any thought to my burial yet.
Yeah, nor have I.
Or my cremation, I should
nor
say.
Nor have I, which is healthy because it means we're all probably in a more positive mood, I suspect. Amy, tell us about your film, A Will for the Woods. It's about one man's journey towards his own funeral, but also about this growing green funeral movement. What is that movement and why did you want to make this film?
The green burial movement is very much taking off in the United States and in the UK as well. It's a movement to create cemeteries that are more like natural areas, and they use burial, the money they raise through burial, to acquire, restore and conserve land. Basically, these places are sacred burial grounds. There's no vault, which is like a cement steel grave liner. The caskets are biodegradable, made out of sustainably harvested materials. Usually there's a small field stone marking the grave, or you can have a memorial planting. It's just an idea that's really connecting with people, and our film really does focus on Clark Wong and his personal journey battling lymphoma and also preparing for his own green burial, because as much as it's an environmental movement, it's an emotional and spiritual choice as well.
Is it a big thing?
So far in Australia, it's been slow to get off the ground because cemeteries are usually government run, so it's difficult for environmental entrepreneurs to come in.
There's a lot of privately run cemeteries too, I understand. It's just that the regulations are restrictive, is that right?
Yeah, and there are definitely a lot of advocates and people trying to start spaces that they want to conserve through green burial who are trying to run, you know, co-op cemeteries, and or they're giving the land to a trust. It mainly the perpetuity issue is something.
Simran, this film, it's a great example of how everything we do from birth to death, which is its subject, impacts the planet in some way, which we all know now. Can we get bogged down in worrying about our impact too much? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I think that line is based on one's individual needs and demands. For me, certainly, I'm aware that I got on a plane that burned a lot of fossil fuel to get here to Australia, but I came here to engage in speaking, you know, engagements and to talk about my book, which are two things I believe in and I think have a net positive impact in terms of talking about environmental issues. So I think the most important thing to remember is that we do have an impact and that there's no real way, unless we're living off the grid, making our own clothes, growing all of our own food and somehow or another harnessing our own energy, we're having a negative impact. And rather than spending too much time focusing on that, I would rather look at the positive impact people are making and have conversations around that.
So you've come from MTV to Eco Hero, which is how people have described you.
The Independent in the UK.
Yeah. That was,
yeah.
You haven't used it yourself.
I wouldn't.
Why not?
I think that's quite self-important for starters. I think at the end of the day, the most important thing is to just do a check with your own self and make sure that you're doing the best you can. So,
what are the positives that are happening environmentally? There's still no global agreement, for instance, on climate change. Mm-hmm. It's the Paris meeting. We know that that's the next step, but it might fail again as Copenhagen did.
Yeah.
What are the good stories?
Well, I would say if we're leaving this up to policymakers and politicians, then we're probably not in good shape. But at the grassroots level, there are a lot of wonderful things going on. I was just part of the Sustainable Living Festival, and there was extraordinary efforts to make our food system more sustainable and just and delicious. There's great efforts underway to invest more time and energy in renewable energy sources. There's just, you know, I mean, there are myriad efforts going on. Unfortunately, the ones that are easier to report about certainly are the failures and the tensions and the dramas. So the small, humble efforts that are, you know, happening every day are the ones that tend to get overlooked.
How about the environmental movement itself? Has it been good enough at selling the message? Has it been good enough at recruiting people to its cause?
I would say that it's always a delicate dance of how you approach the subject with people, because people don't want to be made to feel guilty. They don't want to be preached at, but I try and just say, well, our wants and needs are very alike. Like, don't you enjoy having a world where there are more natural areas, where there is more diversity in animals, where we can have food that's fresher and better for us rather than filled with chemicals? For Green Burial, what I like about the idea is that it transcends environmentalism. Half the burial sites in the United States are in what they call red states, in the Republican states, Texas, Florida. They're not in California yet. You know, you would think that they would be all over California, and people are liking it because it's a more sort of do-it-yourself libertarian, in a way of burial. It's just simple, old-fashioned, going back to kind of the way we used to do it. And I think when you can find ways that we're more similar rather than different, then it's more helpful to approach it like that.
On RN Drive, you're in the drawing room with Amy Brown, a documentary filmmaker, and Simran Sethi, an environmental journalist and educator, visiting Australia to share her message. You've also written this book, which I believe is out not until later this year. I love its title, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Are we losing the foods we love?
We're losing all foods. The loss of agricultural biodiversity, I think, is one of the greatest stories that isn't being told. And I learned of this through research when I was in Italy and was meeting scientists about another project that I had been working on. And they said, yes, we understand that you're interested in learning more about transgenic technology and genetically engineered seeds for this proposal that you're working on, but what we're really concerned about is the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And until that point, I was someone who had told many stories about food, care deeply about it. I don't like the term foodie, but I would be pushed into that category of someone who like really loves delicious, good things. And I was like, I don't know what this is. I've never heard of the loss of agricultural biodiversity. So the more I learned about it, I left my post at uni. It was a tenured post. I couldn't get fired, but I decided to resign to do this work. So over the last 2.5 years, I've been on 6 continents going to the origins, the deep origins of our food, and decided ultimately to tell the story through bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer, because those stories are, to Amy's point about like connecting through what we love, those are things that people have emotional relationships with. The staple crops of the world are soya and maize and wheat and potatoes. And if you're Peruvian, I know you love your potatoes, but I don't have those kinds of connections. You know, I get up to a cup of coffee every morning, no matter what continent I'm on, no matter what my work is, no matter who my lover is, like coffee is my constant, you know, and chocolate, you know, was my birthday cake. It was my wedding cake. It got me through my divorce. Like, these are the things that are anchors in my life. So I decided to tell the story through there. And that is essentially a story of the loss of diversity in foods, which puts us in an incredibly risky position moving forward, because we grow fewer varieties, we eat fewer species and varieties, and that just makes everything kind of like one version. So if, you know, a warming planet or a single pest or disease hits, it will, as it did with the Irish potato famine, wipe out the entire crop and put us in a devastating position.
And this is a story, Simran, that people don't know, do they? In fact, the story we're being told is that food is in abundance and that we have so many sources of it. And yet you're telling a very different story.
Yeah.
How difficult is it to actually tell that story?
That's a brilliant question. It's quite difficult, because when you go to Woolies or you go to Vic Market, you're like, what? There's a ton of variety here. Like, what are you talking about? That doesn't even make sense. Certainly at the Slow Food Market, you are actually seeing diversity in action. However, if you go to Kohl's, what you're seeing is a lot of types of the exact same thing, right? So we could say, how many mangoes do we actually see? Oh, it's probably only the KP. The genetic diversity there is very small. How many bananas do we see? How many apples do we see? So on and so forth. So all of a sudden, it's actually, and with packaged food, it's diversity in brands. It's not diversity in food. It's like 27 varieties of a potato chip.
I've got to say, an uneducated comment, and I'm owning this, but fruit doesn't taste like it used to.
No, it doesn't, because we bred it to be shipped long distances, to look pretty on a shelf. We haven't bred it for taste. And that's the tragic thing. A biodiverse diet, which sounds like such a weird term, but let's just say a diversity in the foods that we eat, is more nutritious, it's more delicious, and it's more satisfying. And that's why I'm telling my story through the lens of taste. And I think once people have the opportunity
to explore. Well, that is the hook, isn't it?
Because it was for me.
Yes, it's the hook for me too.
I mean, if the truth of it is, if you want people to worry about farmers in a place they've never been, it's a tough sell. We have more than enough to worry about in our own lives, just getting to work on time and feeding ourselves and making ourselves, you know, healthy and look good. But if I say to you, like, you eat three times at least, maybe, hopefully a day, let's make that experience more delicious. And by doing so, we are actually, by extension, improving the lives of these farmers and improving the planet and safeguarding food for the future. It's a win across the board. And, you know, to the point of me having sort of been doing this work for a while, this is the first time I've been able to share a solution that is just full of joy. It's delicious and spectacular. I'm not asking you to put on a jacket or turn down the thermostat or walk. I'm asking you to, like, enjoy your life a little bit more. So it's been fantastic to do this.
Which food is at immediate risk? I'm now asking you to unveil parts of your book. But
yeah. No, I'm happy to unveil, actually. I want people to know this and start acting before November. And I'm still actively writing it, so anything could happen. But one of the foods that gets talked about a lot is actually a drink, is coffee. And coffee is one of those bellwether crops. And what I mean by that, in terms of climate change, is you see, like, a warming planet compromises this crop significantly. And what researchers have shown is that the wild diversity that we need as our backup system, that forest in Ethiopia, will be gone. 100% decimated if climate predictions hold at the gravest estimate. The most positive estimate is we'll lose 40% of it. But we add to that the deforestation that's going on. And then we see, like, that crop is actually in peril. You wouldn't know it by going to Market Lane or Seven Seeds and seeing you can get a coffee from Kenya or Colombia or, you know, P&G or whatever. But that actually, those are, again, very few varieties that we're relying on. One pest, one disease, a few, you know, Celsius change of temperature, and we could see those things start to disappear.
Amy, what's your next documentary? The Loss of Agricultural Biodiversity? It seems to me like you now have a blueprint here through this book to tell a story in film.
Well, I was actually just telling Simran before you came in that I saw a wonderful film, Seeds of Time, about this issue and following Kerry Fowler, the scientist, American scientist, who is running the Norwegian Seed Bank. Yeah, that was really interesting to me, and I was just very grateful that people are putting diverse seeds into a vault somewhere where, you know, they can be saved. But I know that it's not perfect conditions because they are frozen and they're not adapting to the environment in this sort of frozen vault. But there were stories of living food banks too, which was really great to see and a relief. But the next film I'm just came on board, it's a young Australian man who's just spent the last 6 years in the Mentawai Islands in Indonesia. And he started out not really knowing what he was doing, but with a settled community in that had just been, you know, one or two generations removed from their very traditional way of living in a government-run established area. And over the course of 6 years, he travels all around the islands and he begins to live with a community living completely in their ancient way of life, sustainably and self-sufficiently in the jungle. And the film is sort of the story of these two worlds, and it's called As Worlds Divide.
If there's one thing that I see in common with you both is try to find an accessible way to communicate a really complex environmental message to people.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because everyone eats and everyone dies, right? Those are universals. And if we can tap, I think, more into the things that we share rather than the things that divide us, it is very hard to talk about climate change. This invisible gas that's affecting us, maybe today, maybe in 20 years, all those predictions are always decades away. And you can't see it. I mean, you can see the results, but I'm talking about something you put in your mouth. I'm talking about something you chew and swallow, you know, that you celebrate with, that you honor people with. Everybody has an experience of having lost someone that is precious to them. So we can explore that idea of, like, what does it mean to honor someone's life through the manifestation of their death? What does it mean to live deliciously? What does it mean to actually respect the land and the people who give us our food? And I think those things transcend politics. They certainly can. They're the places to me where the greatest potential lie. But it's not sort of everyday me strategically saying like, oh, how can I get someone like drink my green Kool-Aid? No, it's simply a question of how can we all have a better life and be kind to each other and manifest the vision that we want.
Simran Sethi, thank you so much for joining me on RN Drive. And Amy Brown, congratulations on your film. A Will for the Woods premieres in Melbourne on March the 4th at Nova Cinema as part of the Transitions Film Festival and then screens around the country until the DVD and online launch on April the 5th. And Simran's new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love, is due out in November this year. She's just finishing it. But if you can't wait, she's speaking at a few events on Sunday the 8th of March, All About Women Festival at the Sydney Opera House. On Monday the 9th of March, the Planet Talks at Womadelaide, and Wednesday the 11th of March at the Hawke Centre University of South Australia. Thank you.
Thank you.